Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is December the 15th. We are in Parashas Mishpatim on page 432. And we're up to Pasuk Chaf Ches, verse 28. We're going to have a bunch of different halachos mentioned over here in succession, and we'll try our best to explain each one. It's going to be a little bit hard to explain the progression, but at least to understand each one as we do it. Chaf Ches 28 says, Malei Aschavati Machal Lo Se'acher. Now, the way they translate that is, do not delay your fullness offering or your priestly heave offering. I have no idea what that means.
That's not possible.
I really have no idea what that means.
Well, the high priest used to, pick up the breast and the
I guess so.
Wave it.
Maybe they
like a wave.
To heave it. Okay. And then it says, "Bechor banecha tishenli," the eldest of your sons, your firstborn son, you should give to me. Malei aschavati machalos se'acher is referring to the various gifts of grain or produce that we have to give to the to different entities. There, in every time a person grows produce in Eretz Yisrael, we're talking about what the Torah considers to be a grain, the five grains, which would be wheat, barley, spelt, oats and rye. So those five grains are subject to several different types of offerings. The truth is that it can also apply to, in certain cases, to wine and oil. But we're going to stick to those five grains for now. So when one grows those things, the first thing that they have to, you know what? It's not even true. I'm trying to pick the produce that is universal for all of the gifts, and it's not going to be universal for all of them. Well, let's just pick right now wheat and barley. That should apply to all of them. So wheat and barley, the very first thing that one has to do when they grow wheat and barley is they have to take bikurim. Mm-hmm. What is bikurim? Okay, the first fruits. Now, the first fruits apply to the seven special fruits of Eretz Yisrael. When we say the word fruit, we are thinking about apples and oranges and things like that. But the seven special ones are not only apples and oranges, it's also wheat and barley. But they apply to seven species, which are... What's that? Grapes. Olives, pomegranates, dates, figs, and then wheat and barley. Those are the seven. So they are subject to bikurim, which is that the first ones that ripen, we take to the Beis Hamikdash, we take it to the temple. What happens to it when you get to the temple?
You have to make a special declaration.
Right, and then what happens to it?
You give it to the priest.
You give it to the Kohen. It's given to the Kohen. We don't keep it, we give it to the Kohen. That's bikurim.
That's
right. Well, it is waived. It's true. The next item, the next thing that one does, and this does not apply to fruit trees. This applies to wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye, and it would apply also to wine and to oil, to olive oil. And the next thing is teruma. Teruma is given to the Kohen. So the next thing one does is one has to give a certain amount to the Kohen. How much is given to the Kohen?
10%.
Not 10%. The Torah does not give it, does not say an amount. Any amount is enough to fulfill the obligation of teruma. However, the sages said that one should give somewhere between 1/60th and 1/40th, not less than 1/60th. And not more than 1/40th, somewhere in there. So we'll call it 1/50th, which is in the middle. That would be a typical amount to give. 2%. Yeah.
With wheat, what do you find the first piece that pops?
You're asking about bikurim. Yeah. You're going back to bikurim. Bikurim is determined while it's still growing. You haven't harvested yet. You just see it ripen in the field. Right. Teruma is after the grain has been harvested and now it's in a pile. And then you take 2% and you give it to the Kohen. That's the second gift that is given. So the first is Bikurim. The second is Terumah, which is given to the Kohen. After that, then one has to give to the Levi. What does one give to the Levi? That's called Miser, or Miser Rishon. Miser literally means a tenth. That's literally what it means. One takes 10% of the remaining amount and gives it to the Levi. Gives it to the Levite. That is called Miser. We call it Miser Rishon, the first tithe, because there's a second tithe that is given after that, called Miser Sheni, the second tithe.
Right.
The first one is given to the Levi. The second one is kept by the farmer, but it's not allowed to be eaten outside of Yerushalayim. He takes that produce to Yerushalayim and eats it in Yerushalayim. If the produce is going to spoil by the time he gets to Yerushalayim, or there's so much produce it's too much to carry, then he can exchange it for money and then take the money to Yerushalayim, and in Yerushalayim use that money to buy food and eat it in Yerushalayim.
What kind of food?
That there's various food that's acceptable for that purpose. That's Meiser Sheni. Just to complicate things a little bit more, that second tithe, which is Meiser Sheni, is only done in the agricultural cycle, the 7-year cycle, because the seventh year is called
Shemitah,
which the land lays fallow. So it's a 7-year cycle. This system applies to all 6 years that you actually grow things. In the seventh year, you leave it fallow, so there's no, these laws don't apply, or most of them don't apply. But in the first 6 years of the Shemitah cycle, when one has to go through this system. However, Meiser Sheni, the second tithe, is only given in the first and second years, and in the fourth and fifth years of the cycle. First, second, fourth, and fifth. But in the third and sixth years of the cycle, instead of Meiser Sheni, in lieu of Meiser Sheni, one gives Meiser Ani. Meiser Ani means a tenth to the poor. Instead of taking a tenth and keeping it and being obligated to bring it to Yerushalayim and eating it in Yerushalayim, instead one gives a tenth to the poor. So, again, let's review. Of all the different things that one has to do when one is a farmer in Eretz Yisrael, the first ripening fruit is Bikurim. That's number one. Then one takes, after one has harvested his grain, he takes approximately 2%. That is Terumah, given to the Kohen. He takes 10% of what's left and gives it to the Levi. That's Meiser Rishon. That's the first Meiser, the first tithe. And then, depending on the year, he takes 10% of what's left after that, and that is given, either it's kept and taken to Yerushalayim, that's called Meiser Sheni, the second Meiser, it's kept by the farmer and eaten in Yerushalayim, or in certain years, instead of doing that, it would be Meiser Ani, 10% given to the poor. There is one other thing that's done, but this is not done by the farmer, this is done by the Levi. When the Levi receives his Meiser Rishon, the 10% that the farmer took off and gave to the Levi in turn has to take 10% of that 10%. 10% of what he gets. And he gives it to the Kohen as well. That is called Terumas Meiser, Terumah from the Meiser. So he also gives it to the Kohen. So the Kohen ends up with Bikurim, the Kohen ends up with the Terumah, and the Kohen ends up with the Terumas Meiser, the Terumah that comes from the Meiser. Yeah.
Does the Kohanim share what they got? What if everybody gave to one particular Kohen?
Right. So there are rules about this. The Kohen does not have to share it. He can keep it for himself and for his family. Right. He can. In fact, you know what? Let's hold your question because we'll deal with that in the second half of this pasuk. Okay? In the second half of the verse, we're going to deal with your issue. So this is the system when one grows produce in Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, it's very legislated. There's a lot to do. The types of gifts that are given, they have different status after they're given. Which means, if I take terumah and give it to the Kohen could eat it himself, and he could feed it to the members of his family. What if the Kohen invites me over for dinner? Can he feed me the teruma that he received? And the answer is no, he cannot. Because a zar, a non-Kohen, is prohibited from eating teruma. Not only is teruma given to the Kohen, it is sanctified, and only a Kohen and his family can eat it. Non-Kohanim, that includes a Levi, is not allowed to eat teruma. And it's a serious offense to do so. As opposed to Meiser, Meiser that is given to the Levi, though after I give my 10% to the Levi, he could turn around and invite me for dinner and we could eat it together. It belongs to him, it doesn't belong to me, but it is perfectly acceptable for a non-Levi, and certainly a non-Kohen, to eat Meiser. So the status of the Teruma and the Meiser are different after they are given to the Kohen and to the Levi, respectively. Yes?
Just wondering, is a daughter-in-law considered part of the family?
Depends. You mean
the Kohen's daughter-in-law.
Well, the Kohen's daughter-in-law is married to a Kohen.
Oh, that's true.
Right?
Right. Forgot right. that.
But a daughter who is married to a non-Kohen
right.
would not be able to eat Teruma.
Oh.
Right. Once she marries out of the Kohen family, she is no longer eligible to eat teruma. What's that? I'm sorry?
I thought maybe she visited one time without her.
No. And there is a discussion about what happens in case of death and divorce. But as long as she's married to the non-Kohen, she is now no longer considered to be within the Kohen family, and she cannot eat teruma. Yes?
So, Rabbi Clancy, the teruma smasir that the Levi gives to the Kohen...
Yes.
Could you eat from that?
No. The Terumas Maaser has the same law as Teruma.
Okay.
It now is only permitted to the Kohen and not to anybody else. Even the Levi can't eat it. Once it becomes Terumas Maaser, it's the Teruma that is taken from the Maaser, that goes to the Kohen and it is prohibited to a non-Kohen. Yes?
What does it mean, Maaser... Nishon. What
are
the words?
Maaser means tithe. Rishon means first. And first tithe.
And
Maaser
Sheni?
Second tithe.
Second tithe.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes?
If the poor person actually needed the Maaser, what would he do the other years? And since the seventh year, the fields are open to him, why does he get the sixth and the seventh?
Okay. So, you're asking two questions. You're asking, what does the poor person do in the first, second, fourth, and fifth years? That's one question. And the other question you're asking is that what happens, it would seem that giving him in the sixth year, which is adjacent to the seventh year, would seem to be, you may as well stagger it, make it every other year.
Right.
Because he's going to get in the seventh year, the fields are open to anybody. So the poor person has more produce accessible to him. Which is a good question, which leads me to believe that the process of giving Maaser Ani, giving a tenth to the poor, is not meant to be the only way to sustain the poor. Because like you're saying, it doesn't make sense. What's going to happen the 4 years that the poor person is not entitled to anything? Is he supposed to store up what he gets in the third, sixth, and seventh years? The seventh year produce you're really not supposed to store up anyway. So it doesn't seem to be an efficient process for the poor. Therefore, it would appear that that Maaser Ani, giving the tenth to the poor, is not meant to be the only way to sustain the poor. It is a way to make the farmer cognizant of the poor, attentive to the poor. That every third year, he's thinking about the poor. If he hasn't thought about the poor for the first 2 years, at least in the third year, he's forced to think about the poor. But it's not it doesn't mean that there is not to be any thought about the poor in the other years. That's what it would seem. Now, we'll get to your question in a moment. It's important to emphasize over here, we're talking over here about tithing grain. When we talk about Maaser in today's day and age, which is spoken about frequently, which means a tithe, taking a tenth, we are generally talking about Maaser Ksufim, which is taking a tenth off of our income as tzedakah, as charity. That's called Maaser Ksufim, taking a tenth of money, kesef, from the word money. That's not the same law as this. it is derived from here, it is a similar law to here, but Maaser Ksafim, the rule that we are to give 10% of our income to the poor, that is provided, of course, that the person himself or herself is not considered poor. If the person themselves is considered poor, they're not required to take 10% and give to the poor. But if a person is able to survive on what they earn, then one is required to give 10% of their earnings to charity, to tzedakah, and that is called Maaser Ksafim. It does not only have to be. It does not. The poor are not the only eligible recipients of that. That can also be given to a valid mitzvah observance, to in order to support a mitzvah that is being done. But the poor are the primary recipient of those funds. Yes, Mrs. Starkman, you had a question?
Yeah,
right.
There are other
ways. Yeah, that is a good point. That even with grain, there are other gifts that go to the poor. Excellent point. There's leket, shikha, and peya, which we're going to get to later, which is sheaves that are dropped, the corner of the field, sheaves that are forgotten. Those all go to the poor as well. That is true. What the Torah is saying over here is not really commanding these gifts. These gifts are commanded elsewhere in the Torah. What's actually being said over here is lo se'acher, do not delay. Do not delay these gifts. So one could understand this to mean that when you have the gifts ready to give, which means you harvested and now the gifts are available, give them. Don't delay, don't wait. But our sages explain what is really being emphasized over here is not to change the order of how they're to be done. Bikurim goes first, Teruma goes second, Maaser Rishon goes third, Maaser Sheni or Maaser Ani goes fourth. That's the order in which one is to take off their tithes. So that means that if I have this pile of grain and the Levi is my next door neighbor and he needs his tithe, I shouldn't right away take the tithe from the Levi. First, I should take off Bikurim, then take off the Truma for the Kohen, then take off the Maaser for the Levi. To do it in the correct order, not to change the order. You recognize that because we're dealing with percentages, when you change the order, you necessarily change the amount. Because you notice it was, you take Bikurim, then you take approximately 2%, then you take 10% of what's left, and then 10% of what's left. Well, if you take it off earlier, you're going to be taking off different amounts. So it is important to maintain the order that the Torah prescribes for these laws. That's what it means. Again, the translation they have is, do not delay your fullness offering or your priestly heave offering, meaning different types of offerings that we are required to do. Now, the last half of the pasuk of the verse is Bachar Banecha Titen Li, give the eldest of your sons to me. Give your firstborn son to me. So this is the law of Pidyon HaBen, of redeeming the firstborn. We don't actually take the firstborn and give the firstborn away to God. What we do is we exchange the firstborn for money. And we give five shkalim, we give five silver pieces as an exchange for the firstborn. We've discussed Pidyon HaBen before. We discussed its value. I mentioned to you that it is measured in terms of silver, of the value of silver. It is approximately, the various modern-day sages have debated this, and the generally accepted amount of silver that's necessary for Pidyon HaBen is approximately 96 ounces of silver, which the market for that amount of silver is it's around $100, maybe a little bit more. It's somewhere in there is the amount that one has to give to the Kohen.
96 ounces of silver is very expensive.
Yeah, it's 96. It's 96 grams. You're right. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. 96 grams. Thank you. Yeah. 96 grams of. You're right.
$18,000.
Well, not that much, but yeah. 96 grams of silver. It fluctuates based on the market. Based on the silver market. When I made an opinion HaBen 20 years ago, At that time, the price was about $15. And silver since then has moved up dramatically. So it's much more expensive today than it was then. Okay, so that is the process. That is referred to over here as Pidyon HaBeis, as Bechor Banach Hatzitz. Let me give your firstborn son to me. Now, here we get back to Dina's question. Can you reiterate it, please? I lost track of it.
Giving to the Kohen, if everyone gave to the same...
Yes, okay, thank you, right. So if everybody gave to the same Kohen or the same Levi, then what would happen to the other Kohanim and the other Levim? So the truth is that if you have a Kohen that everybody likes and everybody gives to that Kohen, then he gets everything. It's true. And he's not required to share it. He can keep it for himself. However, our sages did not want any Kohen or Levi to corner the market. Therefore, one of the laws of Pidyon HaBen is that, let's say you have a Kohen who's very friendly. Let's say I have a good friend who's a Kohen. And I'm ready to make a Pidyon HaBen. I'm ready to redeem my firstborn son. So I go to the Kohen and I say to him, listen, you know, I'd like to do a Pidyon HaBen. I'm going to exchange my son for the money and I'll give you the money. And the Kohen says to me, fine, listen, we're good buddies. You give me the money, I'll give it right back to you. Don't worry about it. You know, you won't lose any money over here. You know, I'll just give it to you. You give it, you know, we'll exchange it and I'll give the money right back to you. So in the end, you won't lose any money. So the halacha is that he's not supposed to do that. That we don't want the Kohen doing that. Because if the Kohen is going to, let's say you have a wealthy Kohen who doesn't need the money, so he's just going to make it easy for everybody. Just, you know, you do it with me, I'll give the money right back to you. The problem is that everybody will use that Kohen, and other Kohanim will lose a source of livelihood, which is Pidyon HaBen. It's a source of livelihood for the Kohen. So a Kohen is not supposed to do that unless the person who needs to redeem their firstborn son is impoverished. If the person is poor, then the Kohen is allowed to give the money right back to him. But if the person is not poor, then the Kohen is not supposed to forgive it, to give it back, because then we are concerned that will take away livelihood from Kohanim. So there, that is addressed at least in that matter. But it's true that if you have a Kohen or a Levi who is particularly well-liked and has a lot of friends, they end up getting more. Yes, that is what happens.
But they could give to a colleague Kohen?
They could give to a colleague Kohen if they so choose. Okay. But it's an incentive for the Kohanim, the Levim, to
be nice
to the farmers. Yeah, yes.
Does any of this have to do with the watches that the Kohanim were split up into? Like, would you have to bring these items, Truma or Pidyon HaBen or whatever, to the watch that happened to be
okay, that's a good question. We know that the Kohanim were divided up into 24 groups, and they took turns doing service in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple. The way it works is that those gifts that have to be given in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple would be given to that particular mishmar, to that particular group. But those gifts that are not given in the Beis HaMikdash could be given to any Kohen or any Levi. Most of what we just discussed is not given in the Beis HaMikdash, with the exception of Bikurim. Bikurim is taken to the Beis HaMikdash, and that would go to the Kohanim of that particular watch. But Teruma and Meiser, Trumas Meiser, all these things, including Pinyon HaBen, is given to any Kohen or any Levi. Yeah?
Could the Kohen give back the silver to, like, the boy at his bar mitzvah? That's probably okay.
That's probably okay. With the Pinyon HaBen that we did, you're supposed to give silver.
Right.
So the problem is finding silver coins. You can go to the U.S. Mint and get specially made silver, real silver dollars. Mm-hmm. Today's silver dollars are not silver dollars. The coins are not silver anymore. But you can make special ones. But in the before 19, I think it's 29 or something like that. Before there was a certain point where they changed the makeup of the silver dollar. Before that point, the coins were actually silver. So when I did it I was in Baltimore at the time, the Kohen I used had been involved in Pidyon HaBen many times, and he owned 7 silver dollars from before they changed from the early 1920s. So he sold me those coins. So I paid him to buy those coins from him, and then for the Pidyon HaBen. I gave him the coins as the Pidyon HaBen. So I bought the coins from him. Now I own the coins. And then I gave him the coins for the Pidyon HaBen. So I did not know what the coins went for. I told you it was about $15. I didn't know. I overpaid him for those coins. So I really didn't know. So he then gave us a gift. It was a baby gift. So he gave us a gift back in the difference of the amount that I had overpaid him for the coins. But what you're describing, which would be many years later as a gift, I'm sure that's okay. The Torah continues, Kein ta'aseh l'sharcha l'tzonecha, so you should do to your ox and to your sheep. Shivas yamim yiyeh imimo, 7 days it will be with its mother. Bayom hashmini, on the 8th day, titno li, give it to me. So just as we've mentioned the firstborn baby child, the firstborn human being that is born, has to be given to the kohen, but of course it's exchanged, then the same law applies to the firstborn of your cattle or your sheep or goats for that matter. This applies to cows and to sheep and to goats. That those animals, the firstborn that you have in your flock, has to be given to the kohen, and that is called bechor, which makes sense. That is called bechor, the firstborn animal, and that is given to the kohen. Now the bechor works as follows: the Yisrael has to take the firstborn and give it to the kohen, firstborn cow, calf, we'll call it, firstborn sheep, firstborn goat. You give it to the Kohen. The Kohen then takes that calf, that sheep, or that goat, and offers it as a sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, and then is able to eat from the meat of that calf, or that sheep, or that goat. If the animal develops a blemish, a mum, and as you all know, an animal with a blemish, a permanent blemish, cannot be used as a sacrifice. So then that animal can be slaughtered normally by the Kohen and eaten in his house. He doesn't need to offer it as a sacrifice. It can't be offered as a sacrifice because it now has a mum. So the bechor, the firstborn, either way has to be given to the Kohen. But what the Kohen does with it depends on whether the animal is blemish free, or whether the animal has a blemish. If it's blemish free, it's offered as a sacrifice. If it has a blemish, then the Kohen can just slaughter it in the comfort of his own property. I don't think you do it in your house, but in his own community, and eat the meat there. You recognize that it is far more convenient for the Kohen if the animal has a blemish. Right, because there's no obligation for him to offer a sacrifice. See, if I need to offer a sacrifice, let's say I'm required to offer a sacrifice, either because the Torah requires me to do it because of circumstances, or I took an oath that I would offer a sacrifice to the temple. And now I have an animal, and this animal is blemish-free, and the animal gets a blemish. Well, that is very inconvenient for me, because now I got to find another animal which is appropriate for this sacrifice. So if I need to bring a sacrifice, I don't want any blemishes, because I want an animal that I can use for my sacrifice. But the Kohen is in a different type of situation. It's reversed. He has an animal which only needs to be brought as a sacrifice if it's blemish-free. But if it gets a blemish, he's not obligated to bring a sacrifice. He can simply eat it at home. So the incentive for the Kohen to have a blemish in this animal is very high. Mm-hmm. It makes it a lot easier. Therefore, Kohanim were unfortunately suspected of deliberately putting a blemish in the animal to prevent them from having to take it up to the temple. That was a common problem, which led to a whole system that was put in place, which was that in order for a blemish to be accepted as a real blemish, there had to be some way of proving that the Kohen did not deliberately do it, because if he did, he would be fined by the courts for having deliberately put a blemish in the animal. I think what is being said is that no one in this room should feel that they're above this problem. That when you have when you have access to something, and all it takes is a little blemish to get it, so people will do it. It doesn't mean every single kohen would do it, but it means that there's a percentage of people that would do it. There was enough people that would do it that it was necessary to have some sort of a system to keep it from happening.
What was expected of the firstborn son to be when Hashem asked that he be presented to you?
Well, the original system was supposed to be that the firstborn son would be the priest in the temple.
Kohen?
Yes.
Regardless of whether he's from a Kohen.
Right. Well, there was originally the original Kohanim were the firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
It was only with the golden calf where the only tribe that didn't sin was Levi.
Mm-hmm.
So then the tribe of Levi, and actually a subset of the tribe of Levi, replaced the firstborn of everybody else.
Right.
But the truth is that in the perfect sense, you're right. The firstborn really would be given to Hashem, so to speak, because they would be the priests in the temple. Yeah. Yeah.
Where do we learn that the pinyan haben is 30 days? It's from somewhere else?
Yeah, it's not over here. Right.
Okay.
Right. The fact that it's 30 days, the fact that you redeem with 5 coins is not mentioned over here. It's mentioned elsewhere. However, it's good that you mentioned that, because what the commentaries say over here is that when it says, so you should do with your ox and with your sheep and goats,
mm-hmm.
The law is that if I have a firstborn calf or sheep or goat, then ideally I should hold on to it for 30 days before giving it to the Kohen. Because if you think about it, the newborn animal is a bundle. I mean, you really have to take care of it. It's not like it's so simple. I mean, we're not farmers. But a newborn animal takes a lot of care, and you have to raise it, and So the Yisrael, the non-Kohen, is obligated to care for the animal for 30 days and then give it to the Kohen. The balance of the pasuk of the verse that says 7 days it will be with its mother, on the 8th day give it to me, that is talking to the Kohen that if the Kohen would like to take it more quickly, which he can, if the Kohen wants to take it off my hands before 30 days. Gesunte hate,
mm-hmm.
Right? I don't want to deal with it. So if you want it, you can take it earlier. If he does, the minimum amount of time that the animal has to be kept before offering as a sacrifice is 7 days. It's invalid for a sacrifice till the 8th day. Similar to a baby boy that does not get a bris mila, you don't do the circumcision till the 8th day. An animal is invalid as a sacrifice until it is at least 8 days old. Now, typically, you'd wait longer than that. An 8-day-old animal is a pretty small animal. But the earliest an animal could be offered as a sacrifice is at 8 days. Now, there are 20... I'm sorry, we'll get to your question in a second. There are 24 different gifts that are given to the Kohen. We're listing some of them here. They're all listed in Parshas Korach, which is in Sefer Bamidbar. It's later on. But some of them are being listed over here. We've mentioned Bikurim, we mentioned Truma, we mentioned Trumas Meiser, we mentioned Pidyon HaBen, and now we've mentioned Bechor, the firstborn animal that's given to the Kohen. All these are different types of gifts that we are obligated to give to the Kohen. There is a total of 24 that are given to the Kohen. Yeah?
During today, and so what happens to the animal?
Okay, good question. What happens today when a Jew owns a cow, a sheep, or a goat, and has a firstborn? So what is the law? And the answer is that yes, the law does apply, and therefore the animal cannot be slaughtered, cannot be worked, nothing can be done with the animal until the animal gets a blemish. And you have to let the animal graze and just, live a carefree life until the animal gets a blemish. Once the animal gets a blemish, then it can be slaughtered. Because of this, it is considered to be appropriate to try to avoid this problem, because an animal that you can't do anything with is a significant liability,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's male, which is what we're talking about over here, only male animals, male firstborn. So a male that is just left to run wild. You can't do anything with it. You cannot work it. You cannot break it in. You cannot do anything. You just have to let it go. So it is a significant liability. And so in order to avoid this problem, it's appropriate to try to avoid it. The way that it is avoided is similar to what we do with chametz for Pesach. How do we avoid owning chametz on Pesach? We sell it to a non-Jew. So here as well, this law only applies to the firstborn that's owned by a Jew. But if the firstborn is owned by a non-Jew, then the law doesn't apply. And therefore, a very similar system to chametz with Pesach is set up for a situation where a farmer has a female sheep or goat or cow, and it is about to deliver for the first time. This only applies the first time the animal ever delivers. Just like with a human being, it's only for the first time the mother would deliver. Here it's also only the first time that the animal would deliver. And in that case, so an arrangement is made that the non-Jew should own the fetus, so that when it's born, there shouldn't be a problem of Bukhar, and then of course the exchange is made back the other way, so that the Jew gets it back, and then they avoid the problem. There is a farm in Maryland that is owned by a religious Jew, and a lot of these laws, which are rarely practiced because we're not agricultural today, so we just don't have these things in place, we rarely come in contact with him, and he uses his farm as a way of educating people in some of these laws. And he described that at one time I believe it had to do with having a firstborn animal, that he had not realized that one of his female animals was pregnant, and eventually a firstborn was born. And
it has to be a firstborn male?
Yes. Yeah.
So it doesn't just apply in Israel. It applies.
Right. This applies. Yeah. This is everywhere. Right.
Isn't there something about a firstborn donkey as well?
Yes. Yes. That we'll get to later.
Okay.
That's a different law. The firstborn donkey is exchanged with a sheep, and given to a kohen.
But it's not treated here.
No, there's no law over there of being a sacrifice. That's just a pure gift to the kohen. Yeah. The Pasuk Lamed verse 30. Va'anshe kodesh tiyun li. You shall be people of sanctity to me. You shall be sanctified people to me. Uvasar basada trefa lo sochelu. Meat in the field that is torn apart, you shall not eat. Lakelev tashlichuno, so to the dog you shall throw it. So here we have one of the laws of kosher. Now you know that kosher, in terms of meat, has two different parts to meat being kosher. One is you have to have a kosher type of animal. So we all know that a pig is not a kosher type of animal. It's got to be a kosher type of animal, which would be a sheep, a goat, a cow, a deer, something like that. But in addition to that, the kosher type of animal has to be slaughtered properly. And if it's not slaughtered properly, then it is also not kosher. So that beef, which hasn't been slaughtered properly, is also not kosher. So here, if one finds in the field meat that has been torn apart, as it said over here, was torn in the field, so that is not kosher, and you can't eat it, and you have to give it to the dog. Now, the truth is that the term terefa is not really the term used for an animal that has not been slaughtered properly. The term for an animal not having been slaughtered properly is called nevela. Terefa is actually the term for an animal that has, what's that? That has an internal problem, an internal physical problem that renders the animal the status of terefa. For example, it has a hole in the lung, it has a hole in the heart, it has a hole in the brain, something like that, which would give the animal status of terefa. We discussed this before. And that type of animal, even if you then slaughter it properly, the animal is still not kosher. because it has the status of terefa. So we really have two different things. We have nevela and we have terefa. Nevela means an animal that has not been slaughtered properly. For instance, the animal has been shot, that's not kosher. Or even an animal that has been slaughtered properly, but it has an internal problem, a physical problem, then it will also not be kosher because it's called a terefa. Either way, the animal is not kosher to eat. And the Torah says, give it to the dog, throw it to the dog. Why does the Torah say, throw it to the dog? Does that mean I'm not allowed to throw it to the cat? Does that mean that I'm not allowed to sell it to a non-Jew? Why does it say, throw it to the dog? Yeah? That is precisely what our sages tell us. The Chazal tell us that here Hashem is saying that I want to reward the dogs. The dogs, when we left Egypt, were quiet. They did not bark when we left Egypt. Lo yecheras kelav l'shono, that the dogs would not bark, which was uncharacteristic because there was a lot going on there that night in Egypt. A lot of people were dead. A lot of people were screaming. And we were leaving, and the dogs kept quiet. The dogs did not harass us when we left Egypt. And Hashem says, therefore, I want to reward the dog. And when you have a piece of meat which is not kosher, you should give it to the dog. A dog is an animal that, although in the United States we have found that people have become very attached to their pet dogs, other pets as well, but dogs in particular, and people treat dogs very, very well. The dog traditionally has always been known, not just in the Chumash, but in all societies, the dog has been that animal that has been mistreated and not cared for. It's the example of the animal that just is, you know, go fight here, go forage for its own food. We don't, you know, you don't feed the dog. You don't. It's a dog is never treated in general society as an animal that's cared for properly. Today things have changed a little bit in the United States, but giving the food to the dog means to give to an animal that generally has to go forage for its own food, and here you're going to take care of the dog. Now, how are we to understand what the Torah is saying over here? Several questions. First of all, the dogs that didn't bark at us in Egypt, it's highly unlikely that they're the dog that you're going to give your non-kosher meat to in the United States in 2013. Mm-hmm. Because it's unlikely they're still alive. It's also even unlikely that it's descendants of those dogs. That's number one. Number two is the dogs didn't bark at us when we left Egypt. Was that because the dogs were faced with a significant challenge and the dogs had an internal struggle? Should we bark? Shouldn't we bark? Should we bark? You know what? We're not going to bark. So Hashem says, oh, great. We're going to reward you by giving you the non-kosher meat. Or is it that the dogs didn't bark because Hashem didn't let them bark?
Good point.
Okay, so what are they being rewarded for? What did the dog do that it gets rewarded? The dog didn't do anything. The dog wanted to bark, but Hashem didn't let the dog bark. So why are the dogs being rewarded? So it's really the same question. Why should we reward those dogs? And anyway, it's not the same dogs. So what does the Torah mean over here that give it to the dog as a reward?
It was an item used by Hashem to reveal Hashem's compassion and therefore you want to be reminded of that.
Okay, so you're saying it's not really a reward, it's more remember the kindness that Hashem did for us when we left Egypt, that the dogs didn't bark. Okay. The way it's expressed is as a reward, but what you're saying is for sure true. Yeah.
Maybe it's excessive reward because it's not against the teva, the natural instinct of an animal, that they were quiet. It's true Hashem controls everything, but it goes against the nature of an animal.
Okay, it's true it went against the nature of the animal. The animal didn't decide it, but, okay, yeah. Yeah.
I think it shows that we should have gratitude even to the most lowly factors in our lives, that nothing is too lowly or too disdained to be able to make its contribution and have gratitude shown.
Okay. Okay. The Mishnah tells us that if a person says, if someone who's leading the congregation says in his davening, you know, today our davening is very regimented. So we read it out of the sitter exactly what to say. But it used to be that there was a little bit more flexibility. A person could add some things in, make up what they're going to use, different words, to be a little more creative in their prayers. So if a Shliach Tzibur says that Hashem, you should have mercy on us the same way you had mercy on the mother bird. You told us to send away the mother bird before taking the chicks or the eggs. So you have mercy on the mother bird, you should have mercy on us. So the Mishnah says, if a person says that, Mishaskino, so we quiet him. We stop him. We don't let him say those words. Because the mitzvah to send away the mother bird is not God having mercy on the mother bird. It's a mitzvah like any other mitzvah in the Torah. And every mitzvah of Hashem is a decree. It's not that Hashem felt bad for the mother bird. The Ramban, Nachmanides, explains that. What do you mean? I mean, how do you get away from that? The Torah says, send away the mother bird. How can we not? As human beings, we understand you're going to take away the kids, send away the mother bird. It certainly feels like it's compassionate. So what does the Mishnah mean to say that it's not Hashem being compassionate to the mother bird? So the Ramban explains that what the Mishnah means is the following. It's true that the purpose of the mitzvah of sending away the mother bird is to teach us compassion. That is the purpose. We have to be compassionate people. And if you're going to take away the chicks or the eggs from underneath the mother, you got to learn compassion. You send away the mother bird first. But it doesn't mean that Hashem feels bad for the mother bird. The mother bird is only a bird. It's just a bird. It's not a human being. We care about human beings. Animals don't have the status of human beings. But a person has to be compassionate, and we learn how to be compassionate by how we treat the animals. But it's not the same thing as feeling bad for the bird. It's not feeling bad for the bird. It is that's not a compassionate way to act. And if you want to teach yourself to be compassionate, you got to do this. That's how the Ramban, Nachmanides, explains the system of sending away the mother bird. Here we have a similar idea. What's going on, it appears, is that Hashem is saying the following. The dogs didn't bark at you. Now, of course, the dog didn't make a decision over here. The dog had no choice but not to bark at you. But the fact is, the dog didn't bark. We need to be people who have gratitude for what others do for us. We have to recognize when someone does something for us, we have to recognize that, appreciate it, and express our appreciation. And we cannot be ungrateful. A person who is ungrateful is a person who lacks in their own fulfillment. That is not the way a person is supposed to act. We're supposed to be grateful. If we're going to train ourselves to be grateful, we have to see it in everything that we gain from. So here, the dogs didn't bark, says the Torah, I want you to remember that. Because I want you to remember that the dogs did something that was good for you. Did the dog choose to do it? No, the dog didn't choose to do it. But the fact is, it was good for you. And I want you to remember that, and therefore reward the dog. That will train us that when someone who is a human being, who does something for us, who made a decision to do something for us, that we do not ignore it, and that we are grateful. Similar to, as you know, that when Moshe Rabbeinu, when the first few plagues were decreed against the Egyptians, Moshe was not the one to hit the water to turn it into blood. Moshe was not the one to hit the water to bring out the frogs, and Moshe was not the one to hit the sand to turn it into lice. Because since the water had saved his life, and the sand had protected him by covering up the Egyptian who he had killed, so he, in order to show gratitude to the water and to the sand, he was not to strike the water or the sand. Same question. What do you mean? The water, the sand, they didn't make any decisions over here. And anyway, it's not the same exact water, not the same sand. But it doesn't matter. It's to train us to be grateful when people do things for us. And therefore, even inanimate objects that didn't make the decision, to recognize that we owe them something.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.